Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the March 9th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The spate of uprisings that began in Tunisia in December, that has swept across Arab North Africa and into the Middle East, have only continued to grow, and in the case of Libya have led to what is being described as a civil war. That's what I will be examining today at 20 minutes past the hour when I speak once again with Munzer Sliman, director of Think Tank's Monitor and founder of the Center for American Arab Studies, who I spoke with a month ago today, shortly after the beginning of the Egyptian uprising. The peoples of the Middle East and North Africa, suppressed for decades by dictators and kings, empowered a century ago by the British Empire, have come out in the tens and hundreds of thousands into the once quiet streets and public squares of their countries, demanding an end to tyranny and access to many of the rights that most of us take for granted. The initial response by the rulers in each case has been the same. All promised their peoples increased financial and social benefits as if their protest were limited to bread and butter matters. And it didn't work. Despite violence, a minimum of violence, but violence, the protests have only grown larger. Whereas in every instance a number of protesters have been killed, the next response of most of the rulers, after the promise of new benefits failed to work, has been to wait out the protesters in the hope that they will get tired and go home. That hasn't worked either, but it has been Washington's attitude, particularly when two of its key allies in the region, the King of Bahrain and the President of Yemen, have been targeted. The exception, of course, in drawing the world's attention from the other uprisings, has been the violent response of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, a longtime favorite of some elements of the American and European left, whose only criteria when it comes to evaluating repressive regimes is how they are viewed in Washington. Gaddafi, in a rambling speech in which he appeared drugged himself, accused the protesters of having been drugged by al-Qaeda or were foreigners and he would not put up with their demands that his 42 years of dictatorship come to an end. Like one of his sons had done in an earlier address on state TV, he declared war to the death against the opposition. Internationally, he was quickly shunned, with notable exceptions being Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, and of lesser importance, Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega. Chavez, like the other two, had established a warm friendship with Gaddafi on the basis of their outs with Washington and offered to mediate the differences with the opposition, which the opposition rejected, demanding that Gaddafi step down unconditionally, as those in Egypt had demanded of Mubarak. Gaddafi was adamant that he would not do so, and in the ensuing days he has unleashed his army and air force, rather his special troops and air force, on the largely untrained rebels, while most of his diplomatic corps and many of his military have joined the other side. This, of course, has brought out the bloodlust of the humanitarian interventionists in Washington, London, and Paris, who are now discussing whether or not to implement a no-fly zone over Libya, similar to what was enforced over Iraq and Serbia, which would end up being an act of war. Still, this is a Security Council resolution. It is likely that the Chinese and Russians will not go for it, since both countries have long opposed UN intervention in what they consider to be internal disputes. This leads it to NATO, which, if passes prologue, will have no trouble approving it. Except Turkey will not go for it, but I don't know if Turkey can veto a NATO resolution. What do those opposed to Gaddafi think about this? Initially, their spokespeople were opposed to any outside assistance, saying that this is a fight for Libya and needed to be waged by Libyans. After several days of feeling the force of Colonel Gaddafi's air force, to which they have no counter, some seem to have changed their mind, but there are disagreements within the resistance. In the meantime, there have been rumors that Gaddafi would be willing to step down and seek asylum if he could be promised immunity from prosecution, something the U.S., according to State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley, is unwilling to grant. This is important because under pressure by the U.S., which is not a member of the International Criminal Court, the International Criminal Court has drawn up charges against Gaddafi for the commission of crimes against humanity. Now, one may wonder why, when Israel was bombarding defenseless Gaza in December 2008 and the first 2 weeks of January 2009, killing up to 400 Palestinians, there was not only no effort by Washington to bring Israel before the court, but Tel Aviv's onslaught was given the thumbs up by the White House and both houses of Congress. We know the reason why, of course, and so apparently does Israeli Foreign Minister Ehud Barak, who in an interview in Monday's Wall Street Journal, while visiting Washington, suggested that as a result of the turmoil in the region, the U.S. needs to give Israel another $20 billion in military aid on top of the $3 billion it will annually get until 2019. Said Barak, "The issue of qualitative military aid for Israel becomes more essential for us, and I believe also more essential for you. It might be wise to invest another $20 billion to upgrade the security of Israel for the next generation or so. A strong, responsible Israel can become a stabilizer in such a turbulent region." End quote. The most virulent critique of Barak's chutzpah came from an unusual quarter, Commentary Magazine, the Jewish journal that gave birth to the neocons. In an online article Monday, Evelyn Gordon, an American Jew who immigrated to Israel, noted that, quote, "The U.S. currently faces a massive deficit that threatens the country's very future, and Congress is slashing ruthlessly in an effort to curb it. Almost nothing has been spared the axe, with one glaring exception. A sweeping majority of Congress still opposes any cut to the annual $3 billion in American aid to Israel, because Congress doesn't want to do anything that might imply faltering support for America's longtime ally." Barak, she wrote, acting, quote, "as if he were blind, deaf, and dumb to everything that's happened in America over the past few years, declared that he wants to seek an increase in aid, as if America were nothing but a cash cow with no urgent monetary needs of its own. This is a public relations disaster," she said, "one guaranteed to alienate even Israel's strongest supporters in Congress, unless Netanyahu makes it immediately and unequivocally clear that his defense minister's proposal is unacceptable," end quote. Well, we'll see. Barak is not the only one who's clueless. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Howard Kaur, executive director of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, better known as AIPAC, complained to a $500 a head cocktail party on Sunday that Washington is largely ignoring Israel as unrest spreads in the Middle East. "New people are coming in with an agenda that's purely domestic in nature," he said. "If you ask any of the president's senior advisors, it's about the economy. We have a situation," said Kaur, "where we have a Congress that is in danger of turning away, and we have an administration that has responded to that. If Israel has to think about defending itself against Egypt or, God forbid, Jordan," he wailed, "defense spending will go through the roof," end quote. He was speaking about Israel's defense spending, of course, the quotes around defense there. And it is likely that he took his cue from Barak. But what did you think of this guy Kaur should be forced to register as a foreign agent? Well, now back to Libya and the uprisings, which, along with the economy, are also occupying the minds of the administration and much of Washington. As to how the U.S. should respond to Colonel Gaddafi's offensive, Robert Fisk writes that, as two previous U.S. administrations had done, and, quote, "desperate to avoid U.S. military involvement in Libya in the event of a prolonged struggle between the Gaddafi regime and his opponents, the Americans have asked Saudi Arabia if it can supply weapons to the rebels in Benghazi. The Saudi kingdom," he notes, "already facing a day of rage from its 10% Shia Muslim community this Friday, with a ban on all demonstrations, has so far failed to respond to Washington's highly classified request, although King Abdullah personally loathed the Libyan leader who tried to assassinate him just a year ago." Meanwhile, the pro-Israel think tanks, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and the American Enterprise Institute have weighed in with their opinions. WinEPS, that's the Washington Institute, Jeffrey White suggests as, mind you, low-risk options. They include, quote, "supplying rebel forces with game-changing weapons such as advanced anti-tank and anti-aircraft systems and the training of how to use them, providing fuel and medical equipment, and setting up an intelligence gathering system." This, as I recall, is what they did in Afghanistan for the Mujahideen, with the assistance and funding by the Saudis. By contrast, White considers a no-fly zone to be among direct airstrikes to be among several high-risk options. The American Enterprise Institute, Mark Thiessen, is on the same page. In Tuesday's Washington Post, he writes about the war that the U.S. waged against what he called Soviet expansionism, which included not only Afghanistan, but Nicaragua. They, he writes, speaking of the Mujahideen and the Contras, did not want American soldiers to fight for them. They wanted America to provide weapons, training, intelligence, and other support so they could fight and win those wars themselves. By providing such assistance, America helped resistance fighters in places such as Nicaragua and Afghanistan liberate their countries. It was called the Riga Doctrine, he unapologetically states, and the time has come to apply it in Libya. When will they ever learn? Anti-Gaddafi forces, he goes on, need the same thing as the resistance forces in Nicaragua and Afghanistan needed, which, it turns out, surprise, are identical to the menu suggested by the Washington Institute's Jeffrey White. That the Libyans may not be seeking a protracted war on Washington's behalf apparently did not occur to either of them, but unfortunately that is not likely to matter. Given the influence of both of these think tanks over U.S. Middle East policy, this is how the next U.S. war in the region is likely to be fought. On the other hand, Gaddafi may be stupid enough to furnish Washington with an excuse for a direct attack, as he did in 1981, when he had one of his fighters fire a missile at a U.S. Navy jet over the Gulf of Sidra and ended up with two of his own fighters being shot down. Colonel Gaddafi's intransigence may not only have provided a convenient pretext for another immoral war, but has also relieved the Obama administration from having to publicly address the demands for regime change by the people of Bahrain and Yemen, two of Washington's key allies in the region. That was until yesterday, when security forces in Yemen opened fire at a large protest outside the university in the capital, Sana'a, in an attempt to stop thousands of people from joining a protest camp at the university calling for President Ali Abdullah Saleh to resign. How many were killed is not clear, but at least 75 people were injured, and five critically. These Yemeni protesters, mostly students, have been camped out in front of the university since mid-February. They are demanding that Saleh step down. They're calling for more job opportunities, an end to corruption, and a fair distribution of wealth. News of this and other shootings have spread across the country, and today the protests were expected to be larger than ever. Also in Sana'a yesterday, thousands of women took to the streets celebrating International Women's Day, joining the tens of thousands of men who have been protesting for days, calling for the country's first and only president to resign after serving 32 years. Saleh has insisted on staying on until the end of his current term in 2013. President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton have, of course, are still paying close attention to what has been happening in both countries, as well as in the home of another close ally, Israel's immediate neighbor Jordan, where protesters are demanding a constitutional monarchy. Egypt, of course, is clearly on their mind, if no longer commanding the top headlines. The country has a new prime minister, Essam Sharaf, who was picked by Egypt's military rulers Thursday to replace Ahmed Shafik. Shafik was the last premier to be nominated to be named by Mubarak, and his resignation was among the major demands of the opposition. Sharaf had been recommended for the post by Mohammed al-Baradei, the former head of the UN Nuclear Regulatory Agency and likely presidential candidate. Having been among the protesters against the Mubarak regime, Sharaf returned to Tahrir Square on Friday, where he told a crowd of 10,000, "I am here to draw my legitimacy from you. You are the ones to whom legitimacy belongs," end quote. He was carried off from Tahrir Square on their shoulders. Also on Friday, Egypt's transitional military rulers announced that on March 19th, 10 days from now, there will be a national referendum on constitutional amendments that will also open up competition for the presidency. We'll find out the significance of all of this when I speak in a few minutes with my guest, Munzer Suleiman. Finally, many of you who get your news from the internet are likely to have come across a number of articles that claim the entire uprising in the region has been orchestrated by Washington through the use of a handful of small non-governmental organizations that teach nonviolence. They point to something called an Alliance for Youth Summit that took place in Washington in 2008, in which young political activists from around the world, including Egypt, were invited to attend, and the rest, we are told, is what we are seeing now. Not only is this view both patronizing and racist, it fails to take into account two critical factors, or at least two critical factors. The first is that the majority population in all these countries is young, in their 20s, and it is the young, as we see in this country, who have learned how to communicate through devices that couldn't have been imagined when even President Obama was born. Whereas in this country and in Europe, where there are no restrictions of political activity or public speech, Facebook and Twitter may be seen by older adults, such as myself, as mostly time wasters. In the countries that have risen up against their rulers, however, where political organizing and critical speech have been risky or against the law, they have become the tools of revolution. Dig it.